Shrink Wrap Radio number 549, Developments in Psychedelic Psychotherapy, with Dr. Ben Sessa.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with UK psychiatrist Dr. Ben Sessa, author of the book Psychedelic Renaissance, and who in the last 10 years has worked on several UK-based human pharmacology trials as study doctor or as a healthy subject administering and receiving test doses of LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine. For more information about Dr. Ben Sessa, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Ben Sessa, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello, David. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I understand that you're one of the main psychiatric proponents of legalizing certain psychedelics for augmenting psychotherapy there in the UK as well as around the world.
Yes, it's a small group of us here, really, in the UK. And when I started out with this about 15 years ago, there were really no other psychiatrists who were pushing for this.
Wow. You came up during the raves of the 80s, having missed the 60s with some regret, you note. And I gather that's when you first became interested in psychedelics. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I came from a very literary family. I was the youngest of six, and so my older brothers and sisters, who were some 10, 20 years older than me in span, were real hippies in the 60s. So I grew up having missed all that as a child, but I grew up with a large pile of Hendrix, Dylan, Beatles, Stones, Incredible String Band, Velvet Underground records, Country Joe and the Fish, and all these sorts of things, and the Doors. So my first foray into psychedelics as a very young child was through the music. And then my father was an English teacher, and so there were always lots of books, and I got into a lot of interesting literature, and then expanded that into my own interest in the beat literature, and then early psychedelic writing. Then as a teenager, experienced psychedelics for myself. And that's how I got into it. So I got into it from a recreational and literary and cultural side before I did a medical side.
Yeah, like so many of us coming through that period. And you went on to become a child and adolescent psychiatrist after realizing that most adults in therapy were suffering from some sort of trauma in childhood. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Well, so I went to medical school and finished and qualified as a doctor and did my stint in medicine and surgery. Came to the realization that by far the most interesting part of the body to break was the mind. And so went into psychiatry. And then when I was training in psychiatry, the first part of the training, which is about 4 years, coming across lots of adult patients of all ages, it became apparent that everyone I met, even if they were sort of age 99 years old, they all talked about their issues when they were three. So it became clear that if you were going to study psychiatry and understand the development of the human personality, you really needed to go right back to childhood and look at those very early relationships with their caregivers, because that's where we all have come from.
Yeah, sure. And one of the things that you discovered when you were in medical school, having developed this deep interest in psychedelics in your youth, well, you were kind of shocked to discover that there was no coverage of the history of psychedelics or of its medical potential.
Yeah, it was as if the whole subject had been kind of erased from the medical curriculum. You know, as I said, before I went into medicine, I knew of the works of Stan Grof, and of Leary and of Sanderson, and Walter Pankey and all of that work that was being done in those early years. And I knew that psychedelics were a big part of this history of psychiatry in the 1950s and early 60s. But all of the, or at least most of the cultural, popular cultural knowledge of psychedelics kind of begins with Sgt. Pepper's in 1967. But actually, from a medical point of view, the game was pretty much over by that stage. All the interesting stuff had happened 10 or 15 years earlier. So I would approach my tutors and professors at university and say, you know, what do you know about LSD in the 50s and 60s? And they'd all just, most of them, unless they were very old, wouldn't know anything. All they would say is LSD is a dangerous drug with no medical uses. If your patient has taken LSD, then restrain them and give them high dose sedatives. And that was pretty much all anyone knew about psychedelics. And when I said, did you know that there was a history of them being used? Most people were quite interested. So I put it, I took it upon myself to write an editorial for the British Journal of Psychiatry in 2004 on the subject, highlighting the fact that work was beginning to emerge again. And I thought it would just be a small thing that died and never went anywhere. But what I found was this huge community, well, not huge community, but certainly a small community all around the world of other doctors interested in the topic. So since then, it's just been fantastic, the last 10, 15 years of emerging myself into that research community.
Was there any reprisal on you professionally for having written that?
Not at all. I mean, there were some people, some of my tutors at the time said, what are you doing aligning yourself with this subject? This is career suicide. You know, you can't be talking about this. Why don't you talk about something nice and wholesome like antidepressants or antipsychotics if you're interested in pharmacology? But actually, on the contrary, it's taken me great places in terms of my career. You know, if I'd chosen to study antidepressants or something where 10,000 reports come out a week on those substances, I'd have been a very small fish in a very big sea. But in choosing psychedelics as my career, I found myself, you know, right at the top of the game with all of the established names in a very short space of time. So I kind of cheated my way to the top, really, simply because there's not that many people doing it.
Yeah.
And this is something I always say when I'm lecturing to medical students or other young people in research. I say, look, you may be put off by people saying this is a crazy fringe subject. It is not. You know, this is not a crazy fringe subject. This really is cutting edge neuroscience today. This is where all of the major institutions around the world that are serious about their neuroscience have now got up and running psychedelic programs. So
interesting. Now, your work in psychedelics, I believe, started with Professor David Nutt, who I had not been aware of, but I gather he's one of the important historical figures. And I love the anecdote about his new newspaper piece on equacy. Maybe you can tell that story here.
Yes. So I mean, my work with psychedelics began before I met David. He actually read my paper, one of my papers, and asked me to come and join his department because he was starting to get an interest. And at the time, no, this was in 2007. In 2009, he was asked by the British government to convene a committee of experts to write a report on MDMA or ecstasy to see whether or not it was a public health problem and to get an unbiased scientific opinion to feed back to the government. So he did this and he put together a big group of people, looked at all aspects of ecstasy use, casualties, deaths, psychiatric harms, physical harms, the effect on crime, the effect on families, the effect on children, the effect on society. This big examination of it, in which I contributed a couple of papers about MDMA therapy, presented it all to the government and said it should be in class B, not class A, because it's not as dangerous as it's made out to be. It has a lot of uses medically and we should start looking at it. Now, he put all this to the government, having been invited to do so. and was told, ah, well, oh dear, that wasn't the result we were looking for. So he obviously, as a scientist, said, look, you've asked me to do an unbiased report, and here it is. How can that not be the result you're looking for? Surely the result you're looking for is the truth. And they said, no, we don't want to send the wrong message on drugs, and we won't be soft on drugs. And he said, surely the message to send is the truth. And they took exception to him, taking exception to them, and sacked him from his position at the head of the drug service. So he then went to the press and caused a real stink, really. And he wrote an article called Equacy, the New Danger. And that basically, he chose horse riding as a comparison because approximately the same number of people go horse riding every weekend in the UK as go raving and take ecstasy, about 500,000 to 750,000 people every weekend. And he looked at the rates of head injury and deaths associated with horse riding, and they were some 350 times greater than ecstasy. So he made that comparison, which obviously upset the horseback riding community in the UK.
Right, right. So you had been doing research on MDMA or ecstasy as a adjunct to psychotherapy. And tell us about that work.
Well, I think first thing to say is, we haven't done any clinical research in this country with MDMA yet because there's never been a study. The studies that we're setting up now are the first ones that there's been in the UK in terms of actually dosing anyone. So it's a subject I've been studying for the last 10 years, but we're still not quite at the point of dosing anyone. Mm-hmm. So I've been through the MDMA training to become a therapist. So I'm a trained MDMA therapist now. And, well, why MDMA? Well,
And you got that training where?
In the States with Michael and Annie Mithoffer, okay. who work with MAPS and have done the first studies in the States. So there's only been two completed MDMA studies to date in the world.
In the world, wow.
Both of these are MAPS studies. This is apart from some of the small studies that happened in the 80s, in the early 80s. Why MDMA? Well, MDMA has the most fabulous qualities. If you were to invent a drug to treat trauma, you would choose MDMA. It has a unique receptor profile that ticks all the right boxes to help a person who's struggling with trauma.
Some of those boxes were that it makes them relax, it makes them able to look at things in their lives without anxiety?
Yeah. I came to MDMA through, obviously, I had an earlier understanding and interest of MDMA culture in the rave years. But what I found as I was doing child psychiatry, and then more lately since I've been doing adult addictions, because I now work in adult addictions as well, is that underlying most, if not all, long-term anxiety disorders in adults. This is generalized anxiety disorder, panic attacks, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and even obsessions, and probably a lot of depression, are in so many cases early childhood trauma, such that if you've experienced a very traumatic childhood with child abuse and maltreatment in your 20s, in your childhood years, there's a pretty good chance you're going to suffer with anxiety problems all of your life. And what really struck me as the years went on working in clinical medicine was that the current treatments we have are insufficient for a large number of people with these disorders. 50% of people with PTSD have the chronic disorder that just doesn't resolve. And the main reason for this is the forms of psychotherapies we use are insufficient to really get to the nub of the problem because the patient is so well defended, they'll do anything but talk about those issues. Mm-hmm. And the range of pharmacotherapies or drugs we use, they're what I call papering over the cracks. They treat the patient symptomatically, but they don't treat the cause, and that would be the trauma. So they cover over the symptoms. You know, if you're depressed, take an antidepressant. If you can't sleep, take a hypnotic. If your mood goes up and down, take a mood stabilizer. If you become paranoid, take an antipsychotic. So we just treat symptomatically one drug after another. So patients come into me on 7 or 8 different tablets, all of which are covering up the basic symptoms, but none of which are getting to the nub of the problem. And MDMA has this incredible capacity to allow the user to be with and recall their painful experiences without being overwhelmed by the negative affect that normally goes with recall of those memories. So when you have a problem like PTSD due to, say, for example, child abuse, you'll do anything but think about that abuse. Mm-hmm. And if asked to do so by your therapist, you'll not be able to do so in a large proportion of cases. So what MDMA does is it allows the patient, for the first time in their life, the opportunity to actually do the psychotherapeutic work. And for me, that's a very exciting prospect.
Yeah, it certainly sounds very promising. And I know that here in my local area of Sonoma County, California, back in, I don't know when, somewhere in the mid-70s, there were therapists who were using MDMA. I think the law had not clamped down on that practice yet. And so there were people who had kind of discovered it and were very excited about it.
Yeah, well, it was legal until 1985-86. Okay. And a number of psychedelic therapists did at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, when LSD was banned in 1966, it became difficult to continue research. So a lot of psychedelic therapists kind of, hung up their hats at that point and gave up doing psychedelic therapy, and then rediscovered the art again with MDMA, which was still legal, like you say. So then in some ways, MDMA followed a broadly similar path to LSD, in that LSD was being used legally throughout the psychotherapeutic profession until it became a popular recreational drug in the early 60s and then was banned, which also stopped all the medical use. MDMA was similar. It was being used in the 70s and early 80s legally until it became popular recreationally, and then it was banned. And then, just like LSD, when it was banned, it really took off from a recreational. As did MDMA, you know, really took off in the late 80s when it was banned. But of course, you know, most doctors don't want to break the law. So banning the drug is a very successful way of stopping medical research. It's never been a very successful way of stopping recreational use.
Mm, good point. Now, you became the first subject in a human trial study using psilocybin under the researcher Robin Carhart-Harris.
Yeah.
Say a little bit about that study, and what was your experience, since you were on the receiving end, what was your experience with psilocybin?
So this was the UK's first ever human psychedelic study since the 60s, and the first with intravenous psilocybin, and we did this at Bristol University in 2009. And this was a pilot study, which later became an imaging study. So I was injected with the psilocybin by a colleague, well, by David Nutt. And I lay in a mock scanner. So it was a wooden MRI scanner just to sort of test what sort of dose we were going to use. Now, on that particular occasion, the effect was very mild indeed. It was more of the interesting effect of it being the historical first in the UK. But what I went on to do thereafter, in the 10 years since then, I've been involved in human pharmacology studies with psilocybin, MDMA, LSD, ketamine, and then a couple of months ago, DMT. So I'm quite fortunate that I can sort of say legally that I've taken all of those different drugs. And I've taken them as part of these research studies.
Yeah, that's really a unique opportunity. You wrote that you have had the marvelous opportunity to be given pure clinical grade LSD, psilocybin, ketamine, DMT, and MDMA on various occasions in a legal setting. That's a fairly unique experience to.
Sometimes I've been the test subject. Other times I've been the study doctor. Or in some studies, I've been both, obviously not at the same time. So it'll be, because these are all studies that are preclinical studies. These are studies not done on patients. These are studies where they've needed healthy volunteers. And, you know, most of the healthy volunteers that have come forward are people within the department who they know and that kind of thing. So that's how I've been fortunate. But I don't think anyone else has been a subject in all of those. So that probably does make me quite unique there.
Yeah. So given all that experience, what have you learned about psychedelics and the potential to use them psychotherapeutically?
Well, it's an interesting question. So, I mean, the different psychedelics have different values. The classical psychedelics are fascinating as tools to see things in a new way and think in an innovative way. And LSD and psilocybin are pretty similar in that respect. We've been using them both injected intravenously. My personal feeling, although others may disagree, is that I think psilocybin is more useful. It has broadly similar effects in terms of its subjective effects, but it's slightly shorter acting, and it's certainly easier to use intravenously because the effect is immediate. Whereas LSD, interestingly, has a completely different onset of action when it's injected. When LSD is injected, the onset is not too dissimilar to taking the drug orally. You know, it can take 45 minutes to come on, and it can last 8 to 12 hours. Whereas injecting psilocybin, it's like being shot out of a cannon. You go from baseline to completely high as a kite in about 3 minutes, and then it's all over in 45 minutes. So it's peculiar how differently LSD and psilocybin act intravenously. So obviously those drugs have immense potential in psychotherapy. What I find clinically with so many patients is I get a lot of patients who maybe thought of by many as not having serious mental illnesses, but they present with what I would call existential angst or a chronic sense of dysthymia, a chronic lifelong sense of not having really found what they want in life. A kind of, it goes along with some personality disorders, I suppose, in terms of a lack of clarity around identity. And what they are just looking for is some kind of breakthrough, like a spiritual or mystical breakthrough. So the idea that we can use a compound, an organic compound, in a controlled way to offer these people a breakthrough is a very exciting prospect. So I think that's where classical psychedelics come in. MDMA, as we've mentioned, its real role is in terms of treating trauma. It's this capacity to engage with painful memories and be okay with that. You know, that's amazing because most of the psychotherapies are so hard to deliver on people with trauma, because by the time they get to the therapist, you know, they have been using alcohol, they've been using heroin, do anything to numb themselves against those feelings. But MDMA has this amazing ability. I think of MDMA as like a sort of life jacket to wear when you go into battle with your trauma. It just gives you that extra edge. And I think that's very important. DMT, hard to imagine its clinical applications in the pure DMT form because it's so rapid. It's over very quickly. It's metabolized very quickly. Now, of course, DMT is growing in popularity in the form of ayahuasca, in which in an oral state, it lasts a lot longer. And there is some interesting work going on around the world with ayahuasca as a clinical tool.
Yeah. By the way, I should mention your book, psychedelic renaissance, which you sent me a, it's going into its second edition, and you tell me it's actually at the printer now. And so you sent me a pre-release digital version so that I can kind of get a leg up for this interview. And it's a marvelous book. I really want to recommend it to people. And you go through all the details of a number of these psychedelics, what their, you know, what their history is, what the psychopharmacological action is, and so on. So I highly recommend that people read this book, the level of detail that they get about these scientific specifics, and also for the wonderful verve and storytelling that you do about your own journey through all of this.
Oh, thank you. Those are very kind words. I'm extremely grateful. The book first came out in 2012, and it was a lot thinner, and no pictures or anything, and it was in paperback. So with this new edition, 5 years on, it's about twice the thickness, and it's in hardback, which is fun, and it's got lots of photos, including some color photos. And it really had to be updated because so much has happened in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. You know,
since the first edition came out, we've had such a host of different studies. So I think the book's quite unique in that it has all the sort of the history stuff about Albert Hofmann and everything, which you'll find in quite a lot of books. But what it also has, which I don't think is in any other books, is just almost in a list form, an up-to-date précis of all the studies that are going on all around the world and all the people involved in them.
And then you've got photos in the appendix of just tons of people who are in and around the whole psychedelic research area.
Yeah.
And often you're in the picture with them.
Yes, some of them are selfies I've taken with people. Because, you know, like you say, it has been very much a journey for me.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm really part of a community of really lovely people. And it's such a great community of people. What's been great for me is, you know, before I went into medicine, I had this interest in psychedelics, which was obviously always a fringe thing because they were a fringe thing. You know, this is a dangerous illegal activity that, you know, you shouldn't be indulging in. But by bringing this into my work as a doctor, it's been a tremendous act of sort of totality for me, because far from it being this dangerous fringe illegal subject, it's now my everyday work for which I get paid, and it's legal and it's not dangerous. And I really do thoroughly believe that these substances offer an important future for psychiatry. And I don't think this is going to stay on the fringe at all. I think that when people take the time to look, that clinicians I'm talking about, when clinicians who may be cynical and doubting at first, because who wouldn't be if you don't know anything about the subject and someone says, give your patients LSD, when they look at the data, I haven't found a single clinician who has actually said that's outrageous. They've all said, wow, does it really do that? And when you say, yes, here's the data, it's hard to not be impressed. I think we have to take great care to not get too carried away and sort of become messianic about this. You know, these drugs are not a panacea that are going to save the world. In a way, that's what went wrong in the 60s, you know, the likes of Timothy Leary, and, you know, it all became too much about saving the world. So I have to hold back, even though I am, you know, tangibly excited. I have to hold back and say, look, these drugs could or could not be really important for the future of psychiatry. Let's not fail to look at them.
Yeah.
And I think when we do look at them, I think we'll like what we see.
But you go through the legal situation there in the UK and to some extent in the US. And, you know, it's wonderful that there is some research that's moving forward. And in some ways, it's remarkable. But both the UK and now the US have I would say, potentially much more repressive governments. And they're already, there's such a repressive atmosphere around the psychedelics and being Schedule One and so on. And one of the stories that I found quite remarkable in relation to MDMA or ecstasy there in the UK is that it was sort of Schedule Three. It was fairly far down. And the beverage industry lobby got upset because people weren't drinking alcohol. They were going to raves, drinking vitamin water, and taking ecstasy. And it made such a hit on the sales of the liquor industry. Here it's Big Pharma and what are the... I think Big Pharma is one very repressive force, and of course religion.
I see the UK drinks industry as their NRA, their equivalent to the National Rifle Association. You know, if you look at the gun ownership data, it's quite clear that it's an incredibly dangerous, stupid thing to do to have The data is unambiguous, yet the law persists. Why? Because there's a incredibly rich and powerful political body that maintains it. I think that drinking is the same in this country. In the UK, we have an extraordinarily dangerous attitude to alcohol. It's so cheap, it's so available, and it causes immense mental, physical, and social problems. And the data is unambiguous, and you can throw the data at successive governments, yet nothing happens. And I think this is because it's a similar thing. We have this powerful drinks lobby in this country that are very pleased that they own the monopoly on the only altered state of consciousness that we're allowed to indulge ourselves in. So the drinks industry are very staunchly opposed to any changes in the drug laws. Now, that all sounds like conspiracy theory stuff, but it seems to ring true.
Yeah, it's, you know, and certainly history shows that people do want to alter their consciousness recreationally, you know, sacramentally, but also recreationally, and always have, probably always will find ways to do that.
Yeah. So, and I think what's kind of interesting, if you look at the whole point about drug prohibition, when I started looking at drug prohibition 20 years ago, the word prohibition, you only really heard it mentioned in reference to the 1920s and 30s, where it was, you know, and everybody accepts that prohibition in the 20s and 30s was a political folly. Everyone laughs at that now as, oh, do you remember the stupidity when they tried that? All the death and pain and crime that it caused. And everyone laughs it off as if that was some silly fate of history. Well, that's exactly what we have. Since the end of the 60s, we've had 50 years of prohibition, and there's no other word for it, and it's caused exactly the same problem. And I'm quite certain we will look back however many years from now, 5, 10, 20, 50 years, and laugh and say, goodness me, do you remember that time from the beginning of the 70s to 2020 or whenever it's going to be, when we attempted to eradicate all drugs by banning them? Do you remember how stupid that was? And all the deaths that were caused, and all the pain, and all the hurt, and all the crime. And do you remember how we created the mafia by doing so? Why did we ever do that?
I
really hope we're going to look back at the last 50 years in the same way as we look back at the 20s, 30s, and recognize it for the folly that it is.
I want to step back to, you mentioned that one of the motivations that people get involved with these drugs sometimes is a quest for spiritual experience. And many people who've taken psychedelics feel that they've experienced God or the divine, or they've tapped into universal consciousness. So despite your own many psychedelic experiences, you're frankly an atheist on the God question, and also see consciousness as an illusion. And so I thought that was fascinating. Take us through that.
Well, this is a very big subject, David, and I get into a lot of debates with my colleagues here. It's interesting. I've always been very anti-organized religion, like many, many people are. You know, a lot of people say, yeah, I'm spiritual, but I don't like Christianity or Islam or Judaism, or, you know, I don't want to be pigeonholed into a box, but I do believe in this spiritual world. I used to be like that, but I've now taken an even further step away and actually said, well, from what I can see, spirituality is a psychological state of mind that has a physiological process, and it's something that all humans everywhere have experienced and will experience, because it's a biological feature of our mind. Like, we're capable of temperature sensation, pain, vision, perception. We're capable at a biological level of believing we're part of something greater. And psychedelics, it's interesting, because for many people, psychedelics for them is validation and justification of a spiritual realm. For me, it's almost the opposite. If on psychedelics you experience a spiritual feeling, surely that's very good evidence of an organic component of a spiritual feeling.
If anything,
a spiritual experience without psychedelics is much better evidence for spirituality than spirituality on them. Where this gets interesting is, and I put it in the book, being a spiritual person, I think, is a good thing for you. I think it's important to get away from the material, and certainly the consumerist viewpoint. And it's important to see oneself as part of some greater cosmic single entity, and the connectivity between people and the connectivity between us and the universe and nature. But I do think this is all a delusion brought on by electrical activity in the temporal lobes. But it's an important delusion. It's a delusion we must fall into, because to deny it denies our spiritual lives. So it puts one in a very difficult ontological position, because by definition, you don't know if you're having a delusion. So you have to fall for your own hype and look at the spiritual side of life, even though you know it's electrical activity in the temporal lobes.
Yeah, and going from what you've said, I think we could say that it has survival value, right? Because it glues people together, it gives meaning, and helps to carry us into the future.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't deny any of that. And in fact, the people I know who are spiritual, even the people I know who are religious, whose religions I don't follow, they tend to be, on the whole, the most lovely, kind, generous, charitable, gentle, peace-loving people. So to follow God seems to be a really good thing to do. But at a neurobiological level, I don't think there's anything spooky going on.
Okay. Now, we've already covered this, I'm not sure. You've likened MDMA to the discovery of antibiotics. How so?
Yeah. Okay, so this is an interesting idea. The idea being that if you go back to 19th century general medicine, at that point, doctors were losing the battle against the infectious diseases. People were dying left, right, and center of respiratory diseases, TB, cholera, problems like smallpox, post-operative infections. These were rife. And we had we treated them symptomatically. We attempted to try and treat the symptoms as they arose, but we didn't know about the microorganisms, and we didn't have antibiotics. And then in the early 20th century, when we discovered the microorganisms and antibiotics, it just transformed medicine. We completely transformed medicine and finally got on top of the major killers of humanity, which were the infectious diseases. Now, back then, before we had the antibiotics, general medicine was very good at what we call epidemiology, tracking disorders, classifying, diagnosing disorders. We knew who got smallpox. We knew how post-operatively infections killed, but we didn't have a decent treatment. Now, my proposition is that we are in psychiatry today where we were in general medicine that 100 years ago. We we know all about depression and anxiety and trauma. We write these long manuals of classification and diagnosis. We spend so much time talking about how you get depression and anxiety, but our treatments are poor. Like I said before, our treatments are symptomatic. They don't get to the cause. So I see trauma as the microorganism. It's an infection. And at the moment, what we do is we paper over the symptoms. It's a bit like taking paracetamol or aspirin. I think you call paracetamol something different in the States, don't you?
I'm not sure what it is, so it's yes.
When you got a temperature.
Yeah, aspirin or ibuprofen.
Ibuprofen, okay. So we'll take those examples. It's a bit like taking those when you have an infection. If you've got an infection, you can take those. They're good that your temperature comes down. You feel a bit better. They treat that symptom. But aspirin and ibuprofen are not antibiotics. They don't actually attack the bug, the organism.
Right.
And that's what we do when we give these SSRIs and these antidepressants for trauma, for PTSD. We bring down the temperature. But we don't, you know, Prozac, antidepressants, they're not antibiotics. They don't get to the trauma. But MDMA does. MDMA is the first real opportunity that we've had of a drug that gets to the trauma, attacks the infection. So can you see the analogy there?
Yeah, sure.
It's a radical new way of looking at trauma,
mm-hmm.
in a way that we've just not done before. So it could be as important for psychiatry as the antibiotics were for general medicine.
Now, people are familiar with the history of LSD, Albert Hofmann, and so on, but you point out that MDMA has a fascinating history. Maybe you can take us through some of the highlights of that history.
Yeah, so MDMA was first made in 1912, I think, by the German company Merck, and it wasn't made as a psychoactive drug, it was made as a precursor, but the patent was put on it then. And then it kind of disappeared from view. It was briefly experimented upon in the 1950s by the MK Ultra CIA organization, in which they were looking at truth drugs, truth serums for the military, but it didn't play a big part. It played very little part in the 1960s. Interestingly, it wasn't really known about. MDA was, but that didn't have a big role. It wasn't really till the end of the 60s when Alexander Shulgin came across the drug and synthesized a new version, a new synthesis of it. And then he introduced it to a West Coast psychotherapist named of Leo Zeff. Now, he was one of these chaps I talked about earlier who'd been a LSD psychotherapist in the 60s, Zeff had, but he'd kind of gone into retirement after LSD was banned. And then when Alexander Shulgin showed him MDMA, he thought, wow, this is a fantastic tool for psychotherapy. So he started using it on patients and gave it to, I think, some thousands of people in the mid-70s, early 80s. And the concept of MDMA as a tool for psychotherapy sort of spread out from West Coast America. But like we said before, broadly similar to LSD, around the same time, the drug started to leak from the medical community and started being used in the underground clubs, initially around the Dallas area. And then it spread via a group of, there's a guru, Indian guru guy called Osho. And he had moved, he'd been kicked out of Oregon, I think, and had moved in the 80s to the Balearic island of Ibiza, of Spain. And he was using it there with his followers. And so we have these two different strands, because there's a strand of it beginning to start getting used in the club scene around Dallas in the early 80s. And then this this group using it over in Ibiza. And then some British DJs came over to a holiday in Ibiza, discovered dance music and discovered ecstasy, brought it back to London. This is like 1987, I think. And then in 1988, it exploded as the rave scene. So now, of course, that's the recreational strand. And the clinical side of it we have a lot to thank to Rick Doblin for this, who was, Rick Doblin was interested in MDMA psychotherapy before it was banned. And then since it was banned in 1986, has worked tirelessly through the formation of this group MAPS to basically get MDMA back into the clinical license books again. And he's been on this fearsome 30-year battle to do so, and has inspired a great many people, including myself, along the way. So it's been an interesting, it's been an interesting story for MDMA, because one of the things that makes it interesting as a research compound is we're having to jump through all the hoops and legal loopholes that you would as if it was a brand new experimental drug that had just been invented yesterday. But it's not. It's a drug that's been known about for a long time. But that's how drug development works. You have to go through these, jump through these hoops. It's very expensive and very frustrating.
Yeah. You know, I was surprised to read that that the raves, along with MDMA, is the rave scene, is still very big in the UK. You write, now in the UK, around 750,000 people take ecstasy every weekend, and over 100 million tablets are consumed annually.
At least, you know.
I don't know if that's going on here in the U.S. still or not. One of my sons was involved with the rave scene for a while, years ago. You know, he's moved on. I was too old to get into it. But is it something that's happening over here still on such a large scale?
Yeah, no, it is, very much so. I mean, I think some interesting things have been happening with recreational drugs in the last 10 years. I think with the internet and with the dark web and with the supplies of drugs, I mean, I work in drug and addiction services, and the old idea of, you know, buying your drugs off some bloke in a pub is so old fashioned now, you know. All these drugs are available online very easily. And I think the repertoire of available drugs has broadened so much. And I think young people taking drugs these days are a lot more sophisticated than they were. There's so much more on the menu. And people use them in different ways, in different scenes. I mean, I guess that's always been around to some extent. You know, you'd have the amphetamines with the sort of heavy metal users, and the psychedelics amongst the hippies, and MDMA amongst the ravers. But there seems to be such a broad repertoire of substances now, which is quite a challenge for those of us in working in drug services, because it's just not how it used to be. It's a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah. You know, I was struck by this passage where you write, the group psychedelic experience at a rave or in a festival is the modern day Western version of a shamanistic community ritual. It's more than just a hedonistic act, more than a mere acute confusional state. It requires hard work, diligence, and careful guidance. And when these factors are followed, it may result in spiritual and personal growth, and play an important role in social cohesion and stability.
Yeah, wow, did I write that? That's great.
You did.
yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the comparisons are very clear. It's at night, it's tribal, it's dark, there's rhythmic drumming. It's very much about being in a trance state. And whether you're on the drugs or not, you know, it has a very communal, cohesive effect on the whole crowd. You know, and I think that's what interests me about the psychedelics, is they're not hedonistic drugs. You know, these are drugs that require quite a lot of time and effort, and if you're going to do them properly, preparation. It's not like just having a pint of beer, you know, casually in front of the game. Usually when people take psychedelics, they do so with preparation and with care. It's not something you want to do all the time. It's not something, I mean, some people at certain stages in their lives will go through a phase of taking ecstasy every weekend, you know, but they soon move on from that and kind of burn out, really. But there's a lot of people, I know so many people who take LSD, they would call themselves a regular LSD user. And when you say how often, they'll say, oh, once a year. So, you know, that's a regular heavy user in some ways. Yeah. And I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, wine isn't like that, or beer isn't like that. You know, those other drugs, or cocaine isn't even like that. They just, those other drugs kind of fit in around your everyday life. But the psychedelics, there's something more cerebral and more intellectual about them. And that really interests me because it means then the community of users tend to be these quite interesting, intellectual, artistic people who aren't using these drugs just to get kicks. They're using them for really important, positive, personal and communal growth experiences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would echo that in my own experience. Now, earlier you mentioned Rick Doblin and the organization he's created, which is called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or abbreviated MAPS for short. Yeah. And in fact, you'll be one of the speakers at their upcoming conference here in the Bay Area this April. What can you tell us about Doblin's work and about MAPS?
Okay, well, so as I understand it, MAPS celebrated their 30th anniversary last year. MAPS was really formed in the wake of the banning of MDMA. So before MDMA was banned, there was a brief judicial period in which judges were asked to look at the evidence. And the psychotherapists at the time who'd been using the drug in the late 70s and early 80s put together their case that the drug can be taken safely, it can be useful in medicine, and it shouldn't be banned. It should be a Schedule 2 or 3 drug, which allows you to do research on it. But the DEA stepped in at the last minute and it got this Schedule 1 license banning, and it stayed there ever since. Now, Rick Doblin was part of the crew who wanted to continue the research. So he really just set his mind to it for the last 30 years. And he spent all these years doing this research from the grassroots up. Now, I think one thing to understand about psychopharmacology research is it's very expensive and very time-consuming. Any human pharmacology research, not just on controversial drugs. You know, if you wanted to do a study in which you gave 10 people aspirin, it would take you 3 years and cost you $100,000. You know, that's just, every study is ridiculously expensive. Now, then you throw in doing it with something like LSD or MDMA or cannabis, and suddenly it's astronomically expensive. So the sort of figure generally is it takes around 25 years and around $175 million to get a drug to market. So most pharmacy research is carried out by the pharmaceutical industry, where they have millions, billions. You know, they think nothing of throwing 10 million at this potential chemical, 10 million at that one. Because if one of them sticks and turns out to be the next Viagra or the next Prozac, then they're laughing all the way to the bank. So it's very easy for the pharmacy industry to do pharmaceutical research. What Rick has done is built up this grassroots movement funded entirely by donations and memberships. And, you know, he spends half his time doing the research and the other half going around cap in hand, scrounging money. And he's just done an incredible job, because not only has he got this research underway to this point where we're very close to licensing it, but he's also such an inspirational figure and has been very inspirational to me and all of my colleagues. He's so supportive. He has such an open door policy to work with young people, especially, you know. So I think he'll really be remembered as an important figure in MDMA, if not all psychedelic research.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to be speaking, as I say, at this upcoming conference
this coming month. Pardon? I spoke at the last two MAPS conferences in 2010 and 2013. And every time I vowed to take my family, well, they've wanted to come with me. So this time they're going to. So The conference is in San Francisco, in Oakland, and we're flying out 2 weeks before to LA and then working our way up the coast as a holiday and then ending up in San Francisco for the conference. So it's going to be.
That'll be great. What will you be speaking on?
I'm going to be speaking on the kind of things I've talked about tonight. I'm going to speak a lot. I think my talk's called A Child Psychiatrist's Perspective, because a lot of people in the MDMA field talk about trauma and they talk about child abuse and they talk about childhood maltreatment. But as a child psychiatrist, I'm actually working in that field as well as with the adults. So I'm very much talking about this developmental trajectory that starts with child abuse and maltreatment and then becomes adult mental disorder, anxiety disorder, PTSD, and addictions. So I'm giving my perspective of just how difficult it is to work with these children and young people, and how so frequently those childhood problems turn into adulthood problems, and how we need a way to tackle that. Now, I'm not talking about using psychedelic drugs on children. Nobody's ever made that proposition yet, that we should be doing psychedelic research on young people. It's more my perspective is seeing how the treatments for adults are so ineffective because they're stuck in their childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about that in the context of MDMA and the fact that we're doing two MDMA studies here in the UK, hopefully starting very soon this year.
I hope so. Now, you've created a psychedelic conference in the UK, which you call Breaking Convention. What can you tell us about that?
The Breaking Convention started in 2010. We've had three meetings in 2011, 2013, and 2015. Our fourth meeting is coming up in June this year. It's at Greenwich University. We bill ourselves as the largest psychedelic conference on the planet based on the number of speakers we have. We have like upwards of 150, 180 speakers. And that's partly because we have what we call a first track, which are all the sort of big names, that the likes with the people that will be at the Oakland conference, at the MAPS conference. But then we have a second track where we really invite young people, undergraduates or graduate students, people who are not published, people who just want to get a foot in the door, and we give them their 20, 30 minutes on the stage. So it's a really packed program. It's 3 days, and it's tremendous fun as well. And I think that's what's one of the things I really like about psychedelic research is, I think it's in the book, I said, you know, imagine a conference dedicated entirely to cocaine. Imagine how boring that would be. It would just be lots of men shouting about their egos. Whereas as a group of drug users, the psychedelic using community, a really interesting bunch, you know, there's so much about art and literature and dance and performance and poetry and color and spirituality, all of these wonderful design, architecture, all of these wonderful aspects of human culture that come into the psychedelic experience. And I don't know of any other drug that's used recreationally that has such a great representation of different facets of culture. So Breaking Convention as a conference, on the one hand, it's a hard-nosed scientific conference with all the top names. But on the other hand, there's plenty of madness going on.
Wow. What was the date of that again?
It's the 30th of June to the 2nd of July. So it's over that weekend. Three days.
Oh, my goodness.
In central London. Come along, David.
Wow. Well, maybe that's a good place for us to wind it up. What do you think?
Yeah. But it's been great talking to you. You know, we've talked about my book and we've talked about my journey. And it's great that you're giving it all this exposure. I think, you know, where I always like to wind it up is, like I said, this is not a fringe subject. You know, this is not a crazy bunch of hippies on the edges of science coming up with pseudo-scientific theories that are going to be dead in the water. It really is not. This is cutting-edge neuroscience. You know, look at the universities, UCL, UCLA, Cardiff, Bristol, Harvard, Yale, New York University, Johns Hopkins University. You know, these are the top neuroscientific institutions in the world. They all have active psychedelic programs running. So if you're a young person and you're interested in this and you approach your tutor and they try and put you off, just tell them to open their journals. Because if they read their peer-reviewed medical journals, they will realize that this is not a crazy fringe subject. This is where it's at. This is brain science of the highest nature.
That's a great wrap-up, Dr. Ben Sessa. Thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks very much.
How delightful to discover Dr. Ben Sessa and the energy and enthusiasm and intelligence he brings to the quest to gain recognition for the power of psychedelics as an adjunct to psychotherapy. It's especially heartening to me to see that there's a younger generation that is carrying the struggle forward to gain sane policies in relation to psychedelics. So far, at governmental levels around the world, it seems to be that emotional fears carry the day. We need sane recognition that these substances are worthy of scientific research, as well as a recognition that people will always have an interest in altered states of consciousness, whether for self-exploration, spiritual expansion, or just recreation. Don't we owe it to ourselves to investigate and legalize those substances that facilitate these experiences while causing least harm? What a shame that besides the fear and misinformation, there are also powerful lobbies that wield big money and political influence to support substances known to be harmful. As one of those early psychonauts myself, it's very affirming to see a new generation of researchers and therapists who've paid their academic and professional dues to achieve positions of influence and to carry this struggle forward. At the same time, I agree with Dr. Sessa, psychedelics should not be looked on as a panacea. Rather, they have the potential to be a valuable addition to our toolbox for healing, self-realization, community, and recreation. I highly recommend Dr. Sessa's second edition of his book, Psychedelic Renaissance, which should become available this June. I have to say he's done an incredible job of providing an overview of the varieties of psychedelics, their impact on the development of religions, shamanism, the Beats, the rise and fall of the hippies, psychedelic music, the rave movement, and more. It's written with both authority and joyous gusto. I didn't even attempt to have him walk us through all of that in our interview. His book has the rare quality of being encyclopedic, yet highly readable, and not overly long. All I can say to you listeners is go out and buy the book as soon as it becomes available, and you'll get a much better understanding of how we all got to this particular crossroad in time. Thank you, Russell Davies. It means a lot to me that you see the value of the work I'm doing here and are willing to support it financially. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Russell Davies and others who are willing to chip in each month? I'm afraid we don't have any new donors or transcripts since the last episode. Let me remind you that there is a link to my Wise Counsel podcast series that you will find on the Shrink Wrap Radio website under the About Dr. Dave tab about six paragraphs down. That series has some of my best interviews. For example, Stan Groff on transpersonal psychology and the meaning of psychedelic experience, Kristen Neff on self-compassion, Joseph Ledoux on the synaptic self and memory reconsolidation, Barry Krakow on PTSD and sleep, Leslie Greenberg on emotion-focused therapy, Bruce Ecker on memory reconsolidation and psychotherapy, John Fredrickson on experiential psychodynamic psychotherapy, Bruce Ecker on coherence therapy, David Wallen on the implications of attachment theory for psychotherapy, Pat Denning on harm reduction psychotherapy for substance abuse and addictions, Edna Foa on the nature and treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, Judith Beck on cognitive therapy and weight loss, Natalie Rogers on expressive arts therapy, Irvin Yalom on death anxiety, Marsha Linehan on dialectical behavior therapy, and Stephen Hayes on acceptance and commitment therapy, among others. These are some of the most major influential people I've interviewed. I get excited all over again just reading off this list. So, go check out Wise Counsel. There are about 120 interviews by going to that link in the About Dr. Dave tab on our site. Finally, here's an Audible.com audiobook recommendation relevant to today's interview. The title is DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. It's written by Rick Strassman, MD, and it's about 11 hours of education and entertainment. In part, here's what the publisher's summary says about this book. I quote, "After completing his groundbreaking research chronicled in DMT, the spirit molecule, Rick Strassman, MD, was left with one fundamental question. What does it mean that DMT, a simple chemical naturally found in all of our bodies, instantaneously opens us to an interactive spirit world that feels more real than our own world? When his decades of clinical psychiatric research and Buddhist practice were unable to provide the answers to this question, Strassman began searching for a more resonant spiritual model. He found that the visions of the Hebrew prophets were strikingly similar to those of the volunteers in his DMT studies." Close quote. Now that sounds pretty fascinating. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one's not to your taste, they now have more than 250,000 titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is meditation teacher and author James Barres, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, James Barres, who was my guest on episode number 239, Awakening Joy with James Barres. Check it out if you're needing a fresh shot of joy. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. This one is from Azriel, who in part writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you as well for reading my last email to you on the air. I must confess to you that your views on synchronicity have started seeping into my psyche, and I have begun viewing the world as a more magical place. How we perceive the mechanism of synchronicity does not affect how it can change your approach to life. Rather than viewing life as some dangerous expedition that has dangers lurking around every corner, I've started viewing the world as a place that has incredible surprises and gifts that can pop up out of their wrapping paper at the most unexpected times." I like that description. "Perhaps this is a possible approach to treating anxiety disorders. If someone can view the world as a place of wonder and magic, then the anxieties will fade into the background. Is there perhaps a modality that incorporates this on some level? On another note, I listened to your podcast about Jung's changing views on Nazism with great interest. Both of my grandmothers were survivors of Auschwitz, and I grew up very much in the shadow of the Holocaust. Both of my parents were born in Europe right after World War II, and both of their families left Europe when the spread of communism threatened their ability to practice their faith as they wished. Jung strikes me as someone who is not especially fond of Jews as a group, but still would not support discrimination and certainly not extermination. This is similar to people in the United States who might harbor racist feelings toward African Americans as a group, and therefore like living in places where there are fewer African Americans, but who would never support overt discrimination against them. Jung probably views the Nazis as a group that might preach death to the Jews, but would not actually do it. He initially seems to have felt that they would be instrumental in fixing the economy, creating jobs, etc. When he realized that they were serious about their plans, he stopped supporting them at all. Is this how you perceive it as well? About, quotes, Jewish psychology, I've seen excerpts of some of Freud's discussions with his students where he discusses the importance of Jung being the, quotes, crown prince and successor, close quote, of his movement, since he is Gentile, and therefore Jung will be the one to take his teachings and de-Judaize them. When Jung started developing his own theories, it was more than a blow to Freud's ego. It was perceived by Freud as undermining his entire kingdom, since with the departure of Jung, his teachings will continue to be perceived by many as Jewish psychology. Any thoughts? Thank you and all the best. Well, Azriel, as always, you are an extremely thoughtful person and well-read, and you ask very penetrating questions. I won't speak to all of them right now, but let me say I love your fresh take on synchronicity. In regard to Jung's possible anti-Semitism, another listener left the following post in the comments area about the Bill Schenel interview. And this listener posted the following. Frank McLean, in his 1988 biography of C.G. Jung, comes to similar conclusions as Schenel. Jung was politically very naive and very conservative, but he finally caught on to the murderous madness of the Third Reich. And he offers the quote, "When the ego identifies with an archetype, madness overtakes the ego." Well, I completely agree with the above observation. I think Jung started out with a naive political view and perhaps some unconscious bias, but I think he quickly outgrew both. I don't think he continued to hold an anti-Semitic attitude toward Jews at large. Also, I believe his mistress, Toni Wolff, was a Jew, along with many others among his followers and patients. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app to do that. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Ben Sessa, for so vividly describing his work with MDMA and other psychedelics. Next week, my guest will be Jungian analyst Jerome S. Bernstein, who, among other things, is the author of the book Living in the Borderland: The Evolution of Consciousness and the Challenge of Healing Trauma. So I hope you will join us then. In the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.